African American giants W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson were tireless opponents of racial oppression and colonialism. Du Bois, author of the seminal books The Souls of Black Folk and Black Reconstruction, was the most prominent African American intellectual leader and political activist of the early 20th century. And the vastly talented Robeson, the son of a slave, was a brilliant athlete, multilingual actor, and one of the most charismatic and important American singers. Yet their legacy of radicalism has been largely rewritten, or simply forgotten. Joining me to talk about the lives and politics of these two not uncomplicated men is Murali Balaji. He's a journalist and author of the book The Professor and the Pupil, The Politics and Friendship of W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, published by Nation Books. He joins me by phone from Pennsylvania, where he teaches at Penn State. We'll talk later about W.E.B. Du Bois's political trajectory from liberal to radical, but I'd like you to start by talking about his early intellectual orientation and political work. And if I may, I'm going to frame it to start with a quote by Manning Marable talking about his seminal book, The Souls of Black Folk, published in 1903. And Marable writes, and I quote, "Few books make history, and fewer still have become foundational texts for the movement and struggles of an entire people. The Souls of Black Folk occupies this rare position. It helped to create the intellectual argument for the black freedom struggle in the 20th century. Souls justified the pursuit of higher education for Negroes and thus contributed to the rise of the black middle class. By describing a global color line, Du Bois anticipated Pan-Africanism and colonial revolutions in the Third World. Moreover, the stunning critique of how race is lived through the normal aspects of daily life is central to what would become known as whiteness studies a century later." Murali, do you agree with this assessment of the significance of the Souls of Black Folk, and perhaps use that to extrapolate and jump off from the early works of Du Bois?
I think Marable brings up, obviously, a very instructive point about the impact of Souls of Black Folk and Du Bois's early philosophical orientation. I'd like to kind of reframe that early education, if I can. The thing that a lot of Du Boisian authors have noted but have not really interrogated as much, I think David Levering Lewis does a really good point of mentioning this, but Du Bois really came up with more of a Eurocentric notion of blackness. And what I mean by that is he came up with this idea that African Americans, in order to achieve the equality that they were struggling for post-Reconstruction and coming into the 20th century, needed to model the way they conceived themselves and the way they were educated to a certain extent around white people. If you read Souls of Black Folk and you read Du Bois's early essays, his study of the Philadelphia Negro, for example, or his essay on the idea of double consciousness, Du Bois has this give-and-take attitude when it comes to race. He believes that black people in the United States can learn from white people as much as white people can learn from black people. What he does, however, is frame the argument in a way that does have some presumptions about who or what blackness is. And again, part of this is his New England background, his early education, and this idea that Du Bois really felt that it would take a class of black elites.
He was the first African American, I believe, to receive a PhD from Harvard.
Absolutely, absolutely. And really, when you look at the and contextualizing this a little bit, when you look at the turn of the century anti-colonial movements across the globe, the elites were the ones. The colonized elites were the ones who really did lead these movements. For example, Gandhi was a British-educated lawyer. And, you know, similarly, Du Bois felt that the education system provided, by white America was going to empower Black Americans, this has become cliche, but a talented tenth of Black Americans to empower the rest of the masses.
Du Bois, I know, later disavowed that, but perhaps you could expand a little on what that means.
He did. And it's very important to note that he disavowed that. And I should just quickly mention that a lot of people to this day are unaware that Du Bois disavowed that idea. But early on, Du Bois had this notion that this class of Black elites were positioned or could be positioned to not only fight for the political rights that African Americans were clearly disenfranchised from en masse, but also represent the interests of Black Americans. He really believed in this benevolent representation of the small class of Black intellectuals, which he obviously considered himself a part of. So, again, when you look at his early intellectual development, going back to Marable's point, I think it's a very, very valid and instructive point. But I think you have to look at the context in which Souls of Black Folk was written and the kind of orientation that Du Bois entered the 20th century with about race, about identity, and more importantly, about the role that African Americans needed to take if they were going to advance themselves.
In terms of that role, he was, of course, instrumental in forming the NAACP and the Niagara Movement. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little more about that?
He was. The Niagara Movement was obviously a landmark in American civil rights. But let me emphasize that it was a landmark in American civil rights. Du Bois and the few Black intellectuals who were part of the Niagara Movement, again, really felt as if this collaboration with liberal whites in forming the Niagara Movement, which again became the stepping stone for the foundation of the NAACP and the Urban League, they felt it was necessary before African Americans could get, in a way, too radical in what they were seeking. And I find it interesting that at this point, when the Niagara Movement started, that really the African American intelligentsia, the political leadership, was not so much content, and I don't want to say resigned to, but really kind of accepted the fact that they were going to be striving for civil rights. And I think that's a very important distinction from the type of radical human rights that you saw other African-American leaders begin to fight for, leading into the Harlem Renaissance, and obviously the type of human rights that Du Bois eventually began to fight for as an intellectual and as an activist.
And I think one of the strengths of your book is the way you lay out the context in which Du Bois and Robeson, who we'll come to later, had to operate within, and the way that they intersected with that. You mentioned the Harlem Renaissance. Obviously that and the First World War had a great effect on the situation of Blacks in America.
Yes. It did, absolutely, Ramsey. The important thing that really, the end of the First World War and the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance was at a period of crossroads in Du Bois's intellectual life. He was in his 50s by this time, and he had seen what happened in the Red Summer. And up until that point, as a socialist, a more of a Fabian socialist, he retained a sense of optimism that there was progress. And there was an essay where Du Bois is asking African Americans to essentially close ranks and support World War One. And a lot of his writings up until the Red Summer, again...
The Red Summer was what, sorry?
I'm sorry?
The Red Summer?
The Red Summer, I'm sorry, I should explain that. Red Summer was the summer of 1919, where there were race riots widespread throughout the United States. A lot of them involved returning war veterans, white war veterans, attacking African-American neighborhoods. This is at a period of time when a lot of American soldiers are returning to find that the domestic economy is changing. And it's also coming at the time when the Great Migration is taking place. Not only are immigrants coming into major cities, but African-Americans are beginning to move from the South, the rural South, into the urban North. Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Washington, D.C., all cities that have already had African-American populations, but seeing a growth in these African-American populations. And what you end up seeing is that there's a tremendous backlash to the presence of African-Americans in these cities. And there are a lot of complicating factors that, you know, I would have to kind of go into a larger discourse, but essentially, witnessing the Red Summer in this in 1919, Du Bois begins to take a little more back from his optimism. He starts to temper that optimism, and he begins to realize that some of his writings about working more in concert with white liberals and white educators may not be as feasible and may not be in the best interests of African Americans as he had originally envisioned.
And so, the Harlem Renaissance provided, I believe, several critics for Du Bois. I should say that the Harlem Renaissance, in the 20s, there was a florescence of Black American artistic and intellectual production based around Harlem, one of these urban centers that you described. Can you describe for us the intellectual currents at play in that Harlem Renaissance and the political orientation of its participants as contrasted to the elite from which Du Bois came from?
Absolutely. Harlem, I think, to this day, represents the expanse of African-American intellectual capital more than any other physical location. There, I think, still exists this homage to Harlem because of what it created in the late 19-teens and into the 1920s, as far as not only the artistic development you talked about, you know, Langston Hughes, Count T. Cullen, the numerous African-American men and women who came into this period and let their arts flow, but it also provided for an against-the-grain class that really began to question the kind of advocacy that the NAACP and the Urban League were trying to advance. What you saw in Harlem during the 20s was the beginnings of the growth of the Communist Party among African Americans. I should also say that when I say African Americans, I should say that it appealed first to West Indians and then to African Americans. You saw Garveyism, and Garveyism really takes shape as the biggest, I don't want to say threat, but it comes across as the biggest nemesis to the type of advocacy that Du Bois and his cadre of intellectuals are advocating. Why? Because Black nationalism clearly disavows the sort of cooperation and the sort of pragmatism that the NAACP and the Urban League are advocating. Remember that in the 19-teens and 1920s, the Urban League and the NAACP consisted, as far as their actual leadership, was still mostly white-run. It was heavily influenced by white liberals. And a lot of the Harlem intellectuals, the young intellectuals who came into almost a coming of age at that period, said, you know, why are we relying on the support of whites to advance our interests and our freedom? And Garvey was the most vocal and the most visible of those opponents. Clearly, he was also the most radical as far as a movement that generated support among many blacks. But, again, he emerges as this very interesting and very persuasive counterpoint to the kind of advocacy that Du Bois and the NAACP are bringing about.
You're mentioning here a variety of confluences that came in to influence the trajectory of Du Bois's thought here. He is known, of course, as the father of Pan-Africanism, yet the Garvey movement, as you suggested, posited a very, very different vision of black separatism and black freedom than what Du Bois and the WAACP had so far done.
Yeah. When you talk about Du Boisian Pan-Africanism compared to Garvey Pan-Africanism, I think it's interesting to note that Du Bois and Garvey's visions of Africa were equally paternalistic. I think a lot of the contemporary views about Garvey was that, you know, he was this populist and that he was really trying to unite the global African cause. There's some truth to that, but Garvey really was looking at, especially Liberia, as a place where Liberia and these other colonized parts of Africa as places where his followers could go and implement their vision of blackness, which would have clearly conflicted with the natives' conceptions of identity. So he had his own paternalistic views. Du Boisian Pan-Africanism was paternalistic because he did not trust African natives in fostering their own independence. He believed it would come at the hands of African-American intellectuals and benevolent Europeans. So Du Boisian Pan-Africanism in the late teens, early 20s, was still very paternalistic and factored heavily in, again, the benevolence of Europeans in terms of facilitating a global free Africa and African diaspora.
But Du Bois was, of course, a passionate anti-colonial advocate. Describe for us the broader context of the anti-colonial movements and the nature of Du Bois's support for them.
Du Bois was certainly passionate in his anti-colonialism. He was always opposed to colonialism, but his opposition to colonialism, as well as the way he saw colonialism, only grew after his visit to Russia and his slow but certain immersion into...
I was going to play after this to lead into the Soviet Union.
Okay, yeah, into the Soviet Union and into the radical left, the global radical left. And I want to say the global radical left because he had a lot of distrust of the American communists through the mid-1930s. His passion as far as anti-colonialism, he certainly envisioned a free Africa, a free Asia, a free South America. But his anti-colonialism, again, was premised upon the idea that African Americans and other colonially educated intellectuals could help facilitate in concert with Europeans the independence of these countries. He did not believe in the sort of self-sufficient revolution that really he came to support later on in his life. But it is fair to say that throughout his life he was a passionate anti-colonial, but the ways he saw achieving that independence and that post-colonial structure evolved over the years.
In 1953, Du Bois gave a talk to the Southern California chapter of the Peace Crusade on the nature of socialism. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of that speech where Du Bois talks about economic exploitation.
The poverty for the worker must be perpetual in order that he be compelled to work for the rich. To most Americans, this paradox is at once true and impossible. They sit dumb and bemused before it. What is life but the attempt of human beings to be happy and contented in a world which, with all its ill, has a mass of sun and waters, of trees and flowers, of beauty and love? To realize this at its highest, we need food, clothes, and shelter. We need health of body and balance of mind. We want to know what this world is, how its wonderful laws act, who its peoples are, and how they think and act, and how what they have done in years and ages past may guide us today. We want to see, realize, and conceive beauty in form and line and color. We want to know our own souls and the myriad-sided souls of others, and then to imagine what might be if what is should grow to what we wish.
And that was an excerpt of a very rare, as you can tell, recording of W.E.B. Du Bois speaking on February the 20th, 1953. Morley, we touched briefly there on the Soviet Union. The Bolsheviks came to power in Russia in 1917. What was the significance of the Soviet Union for black radicals in the U.S. and particularly for the trajectory of Du Bois's development?
It really started with not only black radicals in the U.S., but black radicals in the West Indies and black radicals in England. Before Du Bois's romance with the Soviet Union, you had black radicals such as Claude McKay, William Patterson, going to the Soviet Union and seeing this society where supposedly race and ethnic conflict did not exist. And the Soviet Union presented itself in such a way that appealed, it was the perfect appeal for black and other colored anti-colonials of that time. This notion of workers struggling together for political empowerment, it was such a romanticized ideal and such an appealing ideal that Du Bois' first visit to the Soviet Union in 1927, he sees what's going on. He sees this mass, the Bolshevik Revolution was not yet 10 years old, and he's seeing this efficiency. He's seeing people of different colors walking the streets, and he makes this observation in crisis. He writes, quote, "I am a Bolshevik," and what he means is, I really support this idea of all of these different groups coming together under this idealized state. And again, the Soviet Union presented itself in such a way that appealed to these intellectuals. And, to his credit, Claude McKay and later C.L.R. James and George Padmore, the West Indian radicals, saw what really the Soviet Union was about. But Du Bois was presented with such a rosy picture of the Soviet Union that he was clearly influenced by it. And his thinking was that, look, if the United States can take a cue from the Soviet Union, especially when it comes to the kind of socialist programs that the Soviet Union was enacting for economic development, that clearly, you know, race, I should say that Du Bois began to see the connection between economics and race. And he believed, as he went on in life, that if you solved economic problems, that racial problems would eventually go away.
Crisis, of course, was the magazine edited by Du Bois.
By Du Bois for the NAACP, yes.
He also was very struck by the difference between the race policies of the fledgling Soviet Union and compared them to Jim Crow back home.
Yes, they banned racial discrimination of any kind, and ethnic minorities throughout the expanse of the Soviet Union, tribes, were being integrated into this new Soviet system, which Du Bois and I'll just interject Robeson both thought was a great policy. I mean, clearly in the United States, Jim Crow had precluded African Americans from any sort of opportunity to have equal access to education, jobs, the right to own business. What they saw in the Soviet Union was economic, racial, ethnic minorities coming together and essentially learning as Soviets. What Du Bois failed to see was that these tribes were being Russified. They were forced to unlearn their culture and being forced to integrate into a system that they did not necessarily fit into. So Du Bois saw the rosy picture, but he and Robeson were clearly unaware of the devastating consequence it had had on the hundreds of tribal ethnic minority groups throughout the expanse of the Soviet Union.
That's the voice of Murali Balaji. We're going to take a short music break and we'll be back in a moment.
No more auction block for